Wolf Hall, Disc 13.
He catches Gardiner at Westminster, in one of those smoky back courts where the sunlight never reaches. My Lord Bishop. Gardiner draws together his beetle brows. Lady Anne has asked me to think about a country house for her. What is that to me? Let me unfold to you, he says, the way my thoughts proceed. It should be somewhere near the river, convenient for Hampton Court, and for her barge to Whitehall and Greenwich. Somewhere in good repair, as she has no patience, she will not wait. Somewhere with pretty gardens, well established. Then I think, what about Stephen's manor at Hanworth, that the King leased him when he became Master Secretary? Even in the dim light, he can see the thoughts chasing each other through Stephen's brain. Oh, my moat and my little bridges, my rose gardens and my strawberry beds, my herb garden, my beehives, my ponds and orchard. Oh, my Italianate terracotta medallions, my intarsia, my gilding, my galleries, my seashell fountain, my deer park. It would be graceful in you to offer her the lease before it becomes a royal command. A good deed to set against the bishop's stubbornness. Oh, come on, Stephen. You have other houses. It isn't as if you'll be sleeping under a haystack. If I were, the bishop says, I should expect one of your boys along with a ratting dog to dig me out of my dreams. Gardiner's rodent pulses jump. His wet black eyes gleam. He is squeaking inside with indignation and stifled fury. But part of him may be relieved, when he thinks about it, that the bill has come in so early, and that he can meet its terms. Gardiner is still Master Secretary, but he, Cromwell, now sees the King almost every day. If Henry wants advice, he can give it, or if the subject is outside his remit, he will find someone else who can. If the King has a complaint, he will say, "Leave it with me, if by your royal favour I may proceed." If the King is in a good humour, he is ready to laugh, and if the King is miserable, he is gentle and careful with him. The King has begun a course of dissimulation, which the Spanish ambassador, sharp-eyed as ever, has not failed to notice. "He sees you in private, not in his presence chamber," he says. "He prefers if his nobles do not know how often he consults with you. If you were a smaller man, you could be brought in and out in a laundry basket. As it is, I think those so spiteful privy chamber gentlemen cannot fail to tell their friends, who will mutter at your success and circulate slanders against you and plot to bring you down." The ambassador smiles and says, "If I may proffer an image which will appeal to you, do I hit the nail on the head?" In a letter from Chapuis to the emperor, one which happens to go by way of Mr. Risley, he learns of his own character. Call me, reads it out to him. "He says your antecedents are obscure, your youth reckless and wild, that you are a heretic of long standing, a disgrace to the office of counsellor, but personally he finds you a man of good cheer, liberal, open-handed, gracious." I knew he liked me. I should ask him for a job. "He says that the way you got into the King's confidence, you promised you would make him the richest king England has ever had." He smiles. Late in May, two fish of prodigal size are caught in the Thames, or rather they are washed up, dying on the muddy shore. "Am I expected to do something about it?" he says when Joanne brings the news in. "No," she says. "At least I don't think so. It's important, isn't it? It's an omen, that's all." In late July, he has a letter from Cranmer in Nuremberg. Before this, he has written from the Low Countries, asking for advice on his commercial negotiations with the Emperor, matters in which he feels out of his depth. From towns along the Rhine, he has written hopefully that the Emperor must come to an accommodation with the Lutheran princes, as he needs their help against the Turks on the frontier. He writes of how he struggles to become an adept in England's usual diplomatic game, proffering the King of England's friendship, dangling promises of English gold, while actually failing to provide any. But this letter is different. It is dictated, written in a clerk's hand. It talks of the workings of the Holy Spirit in the heart. Rafe reads it out to him and points out, down at the bottom and running up the left margin, a few words in Cranmer's own script. Something has occurred. Not to be trusted to a letter. It may make a stir. Some would say I have been rash. I shall need your advice. Keep this secret. Well, Rafe says, let us run up and down Cheap. Thomas Cranmer has a secret. We don't know what it is. A week later, Hans turns up at Austin Friars. He has rented a house in Maiden Lane and is staying at the Steelyard while it is fixed up for him. Let me see your new picture, Thomas, he says, walking in. He stands before it, folds his arms, steps back a pace. You know these people? The likeness is good. Two Italian bankers, Confederates, looking towards the viewer but longing to exchange glances. One in silks, one in fur. A vase of carnations, an astrolabe, a goldfinch, a glass through which the sand has half run. Through an arched window, a ship rigged with silk, its sails translucent, drifting in a mirror sea. Hans turns away, pleased. How does he get that expression in the eye, so hard yet so sly? How is Elspeth? Fat, sad. Is it surprising? You go home, give her a child, come away again. I don't reckon to be a good husband. I just send the money home. How long will you stay with us? Hans grunts, downs his cup of wine, and talks about what he's left behind. Talk about Basel, about the Swiss cantons and cities. Riots and pitched battles. Images, not images. Statues, not statues. It is the body of God, it is not the body of God. It is sort of the body of God. It is his blood, it is not his blood. Priests may marry, they may not. There are seven sacraments, there are three. The crucifix, we creep to on our knees and reverence with our lips. Or the crucifix, we chop it up and burn it in the public square. I am no Pope lover, but I get tired of it. Erasmus has run off to Freiburg to the Papists, and now I have run off to you and Junker Heinrich. That's what Luther calls your king. His disgrace, the King of England. He wipes his mouth. All I ask is to do some good work and be paid for it. And I prefer not to have my efforts wiped out by some sectary with a pail of whitewash. You came here looking for peace and ease. He shakes his head. Too late. I was just going over London Bridge, and I saw someone had attacked the Madonna's statue. Knocked off the baby's head. That was done a while back. It would be that devil Cranmer. You know what he is when he's taken a drink. Hans grins. You miss him. Who'd have thought you would be friends? Old Warham is not well. If he dies this summer, Lady Anne will ask for Canterbury for my friend. Hans is surprised. Not Gardiner. He's spoiled his chance with the king. He is his own worst enemy. I wouldn't say that. Hans laughs. It would be a great promotion for Dr. Cranmer. He will not want it, not he. So much pomp. He likes his books. He will take it. It will be his duty. The best of us are forced against the grain. What, you? It is against the grain to have your old patron come and threaten me in my own house and take it quietly, as I do. Have you been to Chelsea? Yes. They are a sad household. It was given out that he was resigning on grounds of ill health, so as not to embarrass anybody. He says he has a pain here. Hans rubs his chest. And it comes on him when he starts to write. But the others look well enough. The family on the wall. You need not go to Chelsea for commissions now. The king has me at work at the tower. We are restoring the fortifications. He has builders and painters and gilders in. We are stripping out the old royal apartments and making something finer. And I am going to build a new lodging for the queen. In this country, you see, the kings and queens light the tower the night before they are crowned. When Anne's day comes, there'll be plenty of work for you. There'll be pageants to design, banquets, and the city will be ordering gold and silver plate to present to the king. Talk to the Hansa merchants. They will want to make a show. Get them planning. Secure yourself the work before half the craftsmen in Europe are here. Is she to have new jewels? She is to have Catherine's. He has not lost all sense. I would like to paint her. Anna Bolena. I don't know. She may not want to be studied. They say she is not beautiful. No, perhaps she is not. You would not choose her as a model for a Primavera, or a statue of the Virgin, or a figure of peace. What then? Eve? Medusa? Hans laughs. Don't answer. She has great presence, esprit. You may not be able to put it in a painting. I see, you think I am limited. Some subjects resist you, I feel sure. Richard comes in. Francis Bryan is here. Lady Anne's cousin. He stands up. You must go to Whitehall. Lady Anne is breaking up the furniture and smashing the mirrors. He swears under his breath. Take Master Holbein in to dinner. Francis Bryan is laughing so hard that his horse twitches under him, uneasy, and skitters sideways, to the danger of passers-by. By the time they get to Whitehall, he has pieced this story together. Anne has just heard that Harry Percy's wife, Mary Talbot, is preparing to petition Parliament for a divorce. For 2 years, she says, her husband has not shared her bed, and when finally she asked him why, he said he could not carry on a pretense any longer. They were not really married, and never had been, since he was married to Anne Boleyn. My lady is enraged, Brian says. His eye patch, sewn with jewels, winks as he giggles. She says Harry Percy will spoil everything for her. She cannot decide between striking him dead with one blow of a sword or teasing him apart over 40 days of public torture like they do in Italy. Those stories are much exaggerated. He has never witnessed or quite believed in Lady Anne's uncontrolled outbursts of temper. When he is admitted, she is pacing, her hands clasped, and she looks small and tense, as if someone has knitted her and drawn the stitches too tight. Three ladies, Jane Rochford, Mary Shelton, Mary Boleyn, are following her with their eyes. A small carpet, which perhaps ought to be on the wall, is crumpled on the floor. Jane Rochford says, "We have swept up the broken glass." Sir Thomas Boleyn, Monseigneur, sits at a table, a heap of papers before him. George sits by him on a stool. George has his head in his hands. His sleeves are only medium puffed. The Duke of Norfolk is staring into the hearth, where a fire is laid but not lit, perhaps attempting through the power of his gaze to make the kindling spark. "Shut the door, Francis," George says, "and don't let anybody else in." He's the only person in the room who is not a Howard. "I suggest we pack Anne's bags and send her down to Kent," Jane Rochford says. "The king's anger once roused," George says. "Say no more, or I may strike you." "It is my honest advice." Jane Rochford, God protect her, is one of those women who doesn't know when to stop. "Master Cromwell, the king has indicated there must be an inquiry. It must come before the council. It cannot be fudged this time. Harry Percy will give testimony unimpeded. The king cannot do all he has done and all he means to do for a woman who is concealing a secret marriage." "I wish I could divorce you," George says. "I wish you had a pre-contract. But Jesus, no chance of that. The fields were black with men running in the other direction." Monseigneur holds up a hand. "Please." Mary Boleyn says, "What is the use of calling in Master Cromwell and not telling him what has already occurred? The king has already spoken to my lady's sister." "I deny everything," Anne says. It is as if the king is standing before her.
"Good," he says, "good."
"That the Earl spoke to me of love, I allow. He wrote me verse, and I, being then a young girl and thinking no harm of it..."
He almost laughs.
"Verse? Harry Percy? Do you still have it?"
"No, Of course not. Nothing written.
That makes it easier, he says gently. And of course, there was no promise or contract or even talk of them.
And, Mary says, no consummation of any kind. There could not be. My sister is a notorious virgin.
And how was the king? Was he...
He walked out of the room, Mary says, and left her standing.
Monseigneur looks up. He clears his throat. In this exigency, there are a variety and number of approaches, it seems to me, that one might... Norfolk explodes. He pounds up and down on the floor, like Satan in a Corpus Christi play. Oh, by the thrice-beshitten shroud of Lazarus! While you are selecting an approach, my lord, while you are taking a view, your lady daughter is slandered up and down the country, the king's mind is poisoned, and this family's fortune is unmaking before your eyes.
Harry Percy, George says. He holds up his hands.
Listen, will you let me speak? As I understand it, Harry Percy was persuaded once to forget his claims, so if he was fixed once...
Yes, Anne says. But the cardinal fixed him, and most unfortunately the cardinal is dead. There is a silence, a silence sweet as music. He looks, smiling at Anne, at Monseigneur, at Norfolk. If life is a chain of gold, sometimes God hangs a charm on it. To prolong the moment, he crosses the room and picks up the fallen hanging. Narrow loom, indigo ground, asymmetrical knot. Isfahan? Small animals march stiffly across it, weaving through knots of flowers.
Look, he says. Do you know what these are?
Peacocks.
Mary Shelton comes to peer over his shoulder.
What are those snake things with legs?
Scorpions.
Mother Mary, do they not bite?
Sting, he says. Lady Anne, if the Pope cannot stop you becoming queen, and I do not think he can, Harry Percy should not be in your way. So shift him out of it, Norfolk says. I can see why it would not be a good idea for you as a family. Do it, Norfolk says. Beat his skull in. Figuratively, he says, my lord. Anne sits down. Her face is turned away from the women. Her little hands are drawn into fists. Monseigneur shuffles his papers. George, lost in thought, takes off his cap and plays with its jewelled pin, testing the point against the pad of his forefinger. He has rolled the hanging up, and he presents it gently to Mary Shelton.
Thank you, she whispers, blushing as if he'd proposed something intimate.
George squeaks. He has succeeded in pricking himself. Uncle Norfolk says bitterly, You fool of a boy! Francis Bryan follows him out. Please feel you can leave me now, Sir Francis.
I thought I would go with you. I want to learn what you do.
He checks his stride, slaps his hand flat into Brian's chest, spins him sideways, and he hears the thud of his skull against the wall. In a hurry, he says. Someone calls his name. Master Risley rounds a corner.
Sign of Mark and the Lion, 5 minutes' walk.
Cormie has had men following Harry Percy since he came to London. His concern has been that Anne's ill-wishers at court, the Duke of Suffolk and his wife, and those dreamers who believe Catherine will come back, have been meeting with the Earl and encouraging him in a view of the past that would be useful from their point of view. But seemingly no meetings have occurred, unless they are held in bathhouses on the Surrey bank. Cormie turns sharply down an alley, and they emerge into a dirty inn-yard. He looks around. 2 hours with a broom and a willing heart, and you can make it respectable. Mr. Risley's handsome red gold head shines like a beacon. St. Mark, creaking above his head, is tonsured like a monk. The lion is small and blue and has a smiling face. Cormie touches his arm.
In there.
They are about to duck into a side door, when from above there is a shrill whistle. Two women lean out of a window, and with a whoop and a giggle flop their bare breasts over the sill. "Jeez you," he says. "More Howard ladies." Inside, Mark and the Lion, various men in Percy livery, are slumped over tables and lying under them. The Earl of Northumberland is drinking in a private room. It would be private, except there is a serving hatch through which faces keep leering. The Earl sees him. "Oh, I was half expecting you." Tense, he runs his hands through his cropped hair, and it stands up in bristles all over his head. He, Cromwell, goes to the hatch, holds up one finger to the spectators, and slams it in their face. But he is soft-voiced as ever when he sits down with the boy and says, "Now, my lord, what is to be done here? How can I help you? You say you can't live with your wife, but she is as lovely a lady as any in this kingdom. If she has faults, I never heard of them. So why can you not agree?" But Harry Percy is not here to be handled like a timid falcon. He is here to shout and weep. "If I could not agree with her on our wedding day, how can I agree now? She hates me because she knows we are not properly married. Why has only the king a conscience in the matter? Why not I? If he doubts his marriage, he shouts about it to the whole of Christendom. But when I doubt mine, he sends the lowest man in his employ to sweet-talk me and tell me to go back home and make the best of it. Mary Talbot knows I was pledged to Anne. She knows where my heart lies and always will. I told the truth before. I said we made a compact before witnesses, and therefore neither of us was free. I swore it, and the cardinal bullied me out of it. My father said he would strike me out of his line, but my father is dead, and I am not afraid to speak the truth any more. Henry may be king, but he's stealing another man's wife. Anne Boleyn is rightfully my wife, and how will he stand on the day of judgment when he comes before God naked and stripped of his retinue?" He hears him out. The slide and tumble into incoherence. True love, pledges. Swore she would give her body to me. Allowed me such freedom as only a betrothed woman would allow. "And my lord," he says, "you have said what you have to say. Now listen to me. You are a man whose money is almost spent. I am a man who knows how you have spent it. You are a man who has borrowed all over Europe. I am a man who knows your creditors. One word from me, and your debts will be called in." "Oh, and what can they do?" Percy says. "Bankers have no armies." "Neither have you armies, my lord, if your coffers are empty. Look at me now, understand this. You hold your earldom from the king. Your task is to secure the north. Percy's and Howard's between them defend us against Scotland. Now suppose Percy cannot do it. Your men will not fight for a kind word." "They are my tenants. It is their duty to fight." "But, my lord, they need supply. They need provision. They need arms. They need walls and forts in good repair. If you cannot ensure these things, you are worse than useless. The king will take your title away, and your land and your castles, and give them to someone who will do the job you cannot." "He will not. He respects all ancient titles, all ancient rights." "Then let's say I will. Let's say I will rip your life apart, me and my banker friends." How can he explain to him? The world is not run from where he thinks. Not from his border fortresses, not even from Whitehall. The world is run from Antwerp, from Florence, from places he has never imagined, from Lisbon, from where the ships with sails of silk drift west and are burned up in the sun. Not from castle walls, but from counting houses, not by the call of the bugle, but by the click of the abacus. Not by the grate and click of the mechanism of the gun, but by the scrape of the pen on the page of the promissory note that pays for the gun, and the gunsmith, and the powder and shot. "I picture you without money and title," he says. "I picture you in a hovel, wearing homespun, and bringing home a rabbit for the pot. I picture your lawful wife, Anne Boleyn, skinning and jointing this rabbit. I wish you every happiness. Harry Percy slumps over the table. Angry tears spring out of his eyes. You were never pre-contracted, he says. Any silly promises you made had no effect in law. Whatever understanding you think you had, you didn't have it. And there is another matter, my lord. If ever you say one more word about Lady Anne's freedom... He packs into one word a volume of disgust. Then you will answer to me and the Howards and the Boleyns, and George Rochford will have no tender care of your person, and my Lord Wiltshire will humble your pride. And as for the Duke of Norfolk, if he hears the slightest imputation against his niece's honour, he will drag you out of whatever hole you are cowering in and bite your bollocks off. Now, he says, resuming his former amiability, is that clear, my lord? He crosses the room and opens the serving hatch again. You can peer in again now. Faces appear, or, to be truthful, just bobbing foreheads and eyes. In the doorway, he pauses and turns back to the Earl. And I will tell you this, for the avoidance of doubt. If you think Lady Anne loves you, you could not be more mistaken. She hates you. The only service you can do her now, short of dying, is to unsay what you said to your poor wife and take any oath that is required of you to clear her path to become Queen of England. On the way out, he says to Risley, I feel sorry for him, really. Cormy laughs so hard he has to lean against the wall. Next day, he's early for the meeting of the King's Council. The Duke of Norfolk takes his place at the head of the table, then shifts out of it when word comes that the King himself will preside. And Warham is here, someone says. The door opens, nothing happens. Then slowly, very slowly, the ancient prelate shuffles in. He takes his seat. His hands tremble as they rest on the cloth before him. His head trembles on his neck. His skin is parchment-coloured, like the drawing that Hans made of him. He looks around the table with a slow, lizard blink. He crosses the room and stands across the table from Warham, inquiring after his health by way of a formality. It is clear he is dying. He says, This prophetess you harbour in your diocese, Eliza Barton, how is she getting on? Warham barely looks up.
What is it you want, Cromwell? My commission found nothing against the girl, you know that.
I hear she is telling her followers that if the king marries Lady Anne, he has only a year to reign.
I could not swear to that. I have not heard it with my own ears.
I understand Bishop Fisher has been to see her.
Well, or she to see him, one or the other. Why should he not? She is a blessed young woman.
Who is controlling her? Warham's head looks as if it will wobble off his shoulders.
She may be unwise. She may be misled. After all, she is a simple country girl, but she has a gift, I am sure of it. When people come into her company, she can tell them at once what is troubling them, what sins are weighing on their conscience.
Indeed, I must go and see her. I wonder if she would know what's troubling me. Peace, Thomas Boleyn says. Harry Percy is here. The Earl comes in between two of his minders. His eyes are red, and a whiff of stale vomit suggests he has resisted the efforts of his people to scrub him down. The King comes in. It is a warm day, and he wears pale silks. Rubies cluster on his knuckles like bubbles of blood. He takes his seat. He rests his flat blue eye on Harry Percy. Thomas Audley standing in as Lord Chancellor, leads the Earl through his denials. Pre-contracted? No. Promises of any kind? No carnal, I so regret to mention, knowledge? Upon my honour, no, no, and no.
Sad to say, we shall need more than your word of honour, the King says. Matters have gone so far, my lord.
Harry Percy looks panic-stricken.
Then what more must I do?
He says softly, Approach His Grace of Canterbury, my lord. He's holding out the book. This, anyway, is what the old man is trying to do. Monseigneur tries to assist him, and Warham bats his hands away. Gripping the table, making the cloth slide, he hauls himself to his feet.
Harry Percy, you have chopped and changed in this matter. You have asserted it, denied it, asserted it. Now you are brought here to deny it again, but this time not only in the sight of men. Now will you put your hand on this Bible and swear before me and in the presence of the King and his council that you are free from unlawful knowledge of Lady Anne and free from any marriage contract with her?
Harry Percy rubs his eyes. He extends his hand. His voice shakes.
I swear.
All done, the Duke of Norfolk says. You'd wonder how the whole thing got about in the first place, wouldn't you?
He walks up to Harry Percy and grips him by the elbow.
We shall hear no more of this, boy.
The King says,
Howd, you have heard him take his oath. Cease to trouble him now. Some of you assist the Archbishop. You see he is not well.
His mood softened. He smiles around at his councillors.
Gentlemen, we will go to my private chapel and see Harry Percy take Holy Communion to seal his oath. Then Lady Anne and I will spend the afternoon in reflection and prayer. I shall not want to be disturbed.
Warham shuffles up to the King.
Winchester is robing to say Mass for you. I am going home to my diocese.
With a murmur, Henry leans to kiss his ring.
Henry,
the Archbishop says,
I have seen you promote within your own court and council persons whose principles and morals will hardly bear scrutiny. I have seen you deify your own will and appetite to the sorrow and scandal of Christian people. I have been loyal to you to the point of violation of my own conscience. I have done much for you, but now I have done the last thing I will ever do.
At Austin Friars, Rafe is waiting for him.
Yes?
Yes.
So now?
Now Harry Percy can borrow more money and edge himself nearer his ruin, a progress which I shall be pleased to facilitate.
He sits down.
I think one day I will have that earldom off him.
How would you do that, sir?
He shrugs. Don't know.
You would not want the Howards to have more sway in the borders than they do already.
No. No, possibly not, he broods. Can you look out the papers about Warren's prophetess?
While he waits, he opens the window and looks down into the garden. The pink of the roses in his arbours has been bleached out by the sun. I am sorry for Mary Talbot, he thinks. Her life will not be easier after this. For a few days only, she instead of Anne was the talk of the King's court. He thinks of Harry Percy, walking in to arrest the Cardinal, keys in his hand, the guard he set around the dying man's bed. He leans out of the window. I wonder if peach trees would be possible. Rafe brings in the bundle. He cuts the tape and straightens out the letters and memoranda. This unsavoury business all started 6 years ago, at a broken-down chapel on the edge of Kentish marshland, when a statue of the Virgin began to attract pilgrims, and a young woman by name Elizabeth Barton started to put on shows for them. What did the statue do in the first place to get attention? Move, probably, or weep blood. The girl is an orphan, brought up in the household of one of Warham's land agents. She has a sister, no other family. He says to Rafe, "Nobody took any notice of her till she was 20 or so, and then she had some kind of illness, and when she got better, she started to have visions and speak in alien voices. She says she's seen St. Peter at the gates of heaven with his keys. She's seen St. Michael weighing souls. If you ask her where your dead relatives are, she can tell you. If it's heaven, she speaks in a high voice. If it's hell, in a deep voice." "The effect could be comic," Rafe says. "Do you think so? What irreverent children I have brought up." He reads, then looks up. "She sometimes goes without food for 9 days. Sometimes she falls suddenly to the ground. Not surprising, is it? She suffers spasms, torsions, and trances. It sounds most displeasant. She was interviewed by my Lord Cardinal, but..." His hand sifts the papers. "Nothing here. No record of that meeting. I wonder what happened. Probably he tried to get her to eat her dinner. She wouldn't have liked that. By this," he reads, "she is in a convent in Canterbury. The broken-down chapel has got a new roof and money is rolling into the local clergy. There are cures. The lame walk, the blind see. Candles light by themselves. The pilgrims are thick upon the roads. Why do I feel I've heard this story before? She has a flock of monks and priests about her, who direct the people's eyes heavenwards whilst picking their pockets. And we can presume it is these same monks and priests who have instructed her to hawk around her opinion on the subject of the king's marriage. Thomas More has met her, as well as Fisher." "Yes, I keep that in mind. Oh, and look here. Mary Magdalene has sent her a letter, illuminated in gold." "Can she read it?" "Yes, it seems she can." He looks up. "What do you think? The king will endure being called names, if it is by a holy virgin. I suppose he is used to it. Anne berates him often enough. Possibly he is afraid." Rafe has been to court with him. Evidently, he understands Henry better than some people who have known him all his life. "Indeed he is. He believes in simple maids who can talk to saints. He is disposed to believe in prophecies, whereas I think we let it run for a time. See who visits her, who makes offerings. Certain noble ladies have been in touch with her, wanting their fortunes told and their mothers prayed out of purgatory." "My Lady Exeter," Rafe says. "Henry Courtenay, Marquis of Exeter, is the king's nearest male relative, being a grandson of old King Edward. Hence, useful to the Emperor when he comes with his troops to boot out Henry and put a new king on the throne. If I were Exeter, I wouldn't let my wife dance attendance on some addle-witted girl who is feeding her fantasies that one day she will be queen." He begins to refold the papers. "This girl, you know, she claims she can raise the dead." At John Pettit's funeral, while the women are upstairs sitting with Lucy, he convenes an impromptu meeting downstairs at Lion's Quay to talk to his fellow merchants about disorder in the city. Antonio Bonvisi, Moore's friend, excuses himself and says he will go home. "The Trinity bless and prosper you," he says, withdrawing and taking with him the mobile island of Chill, which has followed him since his unexpected arrival. "You know," he says, turning at the door, "if there is a question of help for Mistress Pettit, I shall be glad." "No need. She is left wealthy." "But will the city let her take the business on?" He cuts him off. "I have that in hand." Bonvisi nods and goes out. Surprising he should show his face. John Parnell of the Draper's Company has a history of clashes with Moore. Master Cromwell,
If you are taking charge of this, does it mean... Do you have it in mind to speak to Lucy?
Me?
No.
Humphrey Monmouth says... Shall we have our meeting first and broker marriages later? We are concerned, Master Cromwell, as you must be, as the King must be. We are all, I think... He looks around. We are all, now Bonvisia has left us, friendly to the cause for which our late brother Petit was, in effect, a martyr. But it is for us to keep the peace, to disassociate ourselves from outbreaks of blasphemy.
In one city parish last Sunday, at the sacred moment of the elevation of the host, and just as the priest pronounced, Hoc est enim corpus meum, there was an outbreak of chanting. Hoc est corpus, hocus pocus. And in an adjacent parish, at the commemoration of the saints, where the priest requires us to remember our fellowship with the holy martyrs, cum Joanne, Stefano, Matthia, Barnaba, Ignacio, Alexandro, Marcellino, Petro, some person has shouted out, and don't forget me and my cousin Kate, and Dick with his cockle barrel on Leadenhall, and his sister Susan, and a little dog, Posset. He puts his hand over his mouth. If Posset needs a lawyer, you know where I am.
Master Cromwell, says a crabbed elder from the Skinner's Company, you convene this gathering, set us an example in gravity.
There are ballads made, Monmouth says, about Lady Anne. The words are not repeatable in this company. Thomas Boleyn's servants complain they are called names on the street. Orgia thrown on their livery. Masters must keep a hand on their apprentices. Disloyal talk should be reported.
To whom?
He says, try me. He finds Joanne at Austin Friars. She has made some excuse to stay at home, a summer cold. Ask me what secret I know, he says. For appearance's sake, she polishes the tip of her nose. Let me see. You know to a shilling what the king has in his treasury? I know to the farthing. Not that. Ask me, sweet sister. When she has guessed enough, he tells her, John Parnell is going to marry Luce.
What? And John Pettit not cold?
She turns away to get over whatever she is feeling. Your brethren stick together. Parnell's household is not clean from sectaries. He has a servant in Bishop Stokesley's prison, so I hear. Richard Cromwell puts his head around the door. Master, the tower, bricks, 5 shilling the 1,000.
No.
Right. You'd think she'd marry a safer sort of man. He goes to the door.
Richard, come back, turns to Joanne. I don't think she knows any.
Sir?
Get it down by 6 pence and check every batch. What he should do is choose a few in every load and take a close interest in them.
Joanne in the room behind him. Anyway, you did the wise thing.
For instance, measure them. Joanne, did you think I'd get married out of some sort of inadvertence? By accident?
I'm sorry, Richard says.
Because if you keep measuring them, it throws brickmakers into a panic. And you'll see by their faces if they're trying any tricks.
I expect you have some lady in view at court. The king has given you a new office.
Clerk of the Hanoper, yes. A post in the Chancery finances. It hardly signs the flowery trail to a love affair.
Richard has gone, clattering downstairs.
Do you know what I think?
You think you should wait till she, that woman, is queen.
I think it's the transport that pushes the cost up, even by barge. I should have cleared some ground and built my own kilns.
Sunday, the 1st of September, at Windsor. Anne kneels before the king to receive the title of Marquis of Pembroke. The Garter Knights in their stalls watch her. The noble ladies of England flank her. And the Duchess, having refused and spat out an oath at the suggestion, Norfolk's daughter Mary bears her coronet on a cushion. The Howards and the Boleyns are en fête.
Monseigneur caresses his beard, nods and smiles as he receives murmured congratulations from the French ambassador. Bishop Gardiner reads out Anne's new title. She is vivid in red velvet and ermine, and her black hair falls, virgin style, in snaky locks to her waist. He, Cromwell, has organised the income from 15 manors to support her dignity. A Te Deum is sung, a sermon is preached. When the ceremony is over, and the women stoop to pick up her train, he sees a flash of blue like a kingfisher, and glances up to see John Seymour's little daughter among the Howard ladies. A warhorse raises his head at the sound of trumpets, and great ladies look up and smile. But as the musicians play a flourish, and the procession leaves St. George's Chapel, she keeps her pale face downturned, her eyes on her toes, as if she fears tripping. At the feast, Anne sits beside Henry on his dais, and when she turns to speak to him, her black lashes brush her cheeks. She is almost there now, almost there, her body taut like a bowstring, her skin dusted with gold, with tints of apricot and honey. When she smiles, which she does often, she shows small teeth, white and sharp. She is planning to commandeer Catherine's royal barge, she tells him, and have the device H and K burned away, all Catherine's badges obliterated. The king has sent for Catherine's jewels, so she can wear them on the projected trip to France. He has spent an afternoon with her, two afternoons, three, in the fine September weather, with the king's goldsmith beside her making drawings, and he, as master of the jewels, adding suggestions. Anne wants new settings made. At first, Catherine had refused to give up the jewels. She had said she could not part with the property of the Queen of England and put it into the hands of the disgrace of Christendom. It had taken a royal command to make her hand over the loot. Anne refers everything to him. She says, laughing, "Cromwell, you are my man." The wind is set fair and the tide is running for him. He can feel the tug of it under his feet. His friend Audley must surely be confirmed as Chancellor. The king is getting used to him. Old courtiers have resigned rather than serve Anne. The new controller of the household is Sir William Paulet, a friend of his from Wolsey days. So many of the new courtiers are his friends from Wolsey days, and the cardinal didn't employ fools. After the mass and Anne's installation, he attends the Bishop of Winchester as he disrobes, gets out of his canonicals into gear more suitable for secular celebrations. "Are you going to dance?" he asks him. He sits on a stone window ledge, half attentive to what is going on in the courts below, the musicians carrying in pipes and lutes, harps and rebecs, hautboys, viols and drums. "You could cut a good figure. Or don't you dance now, you're a bishop?" Stephen's conversation is on a track of its own. "You'd think it would be enough for any woman, wouldn't you? To be made a marquess in her own right. She'll give way to him now. Air in the belly, please God, before Christmas." "Oh, you wish her success?" "I wish his temper soothed, and some result out of this. Not to do it all for nothing." "Do you know what Chapuis is saying about you? That you keep two women in your household dressed up as boys." "Do I?" he frowns. "Better, I suppose, than two boys dressed up as women." "Now that would be opprobrious." Stephen gives a bark of laughter. They stroll together towards the feast. "Trolley lolly," the musicians sing. "Pastime with good company, I love and shall until I die." The soul is musical by nature, the philosophers say. The king calls up Thomas Wyatt to sing with him, and the musician Mark. "Alas, what shall I do for love? For love, alas, what shall I do?" "Anything he can think of," Gardiner says. "There is no limit that I can see." He says, "The king is good to those who think him good." He floats it to the bishop below the music. "Well," Gardiner says, "if your mind is infinitely flexible, as yours, I see, would have to be.
He speaks to Mistress Seymour.
Look, she says. She holds up her sleeves. The bright blue with which she has edged them, that kingfisher flash, is cut from the silk in which she wrapped her present of needlework patterns. How do matters stand now at Wolf Hall, he asks, as tactfully as he can. How do you ask after a family in the wake of incest? She says in her clear little voice,
Sir John is very well, but then Sir John is always very well.
And the rest of you?
Edward, angry. Tom, restless. My lady mother, grinding her teeth and banging the doors. The harvest coming in, the apples on the bough, the maids in the dairy, our chaplain at his prayers, the hens laying, the lutes in tune, and Sir John, as always, is very well. Why don't you make some business in Wiltshire and ride down to inspect us? Oh, and if the king gets a new wife, she will need matrons to attend her, and my sister Liz is coming to court. Her husband is the governor of Jersey. You know him, Anthony Outred. I would rather go up country to the queen myself, but they say she is moving again, and her household has been reduced.
If I were your father... No, he rephrases it. If I were to advise you, it will be to serve Lady Anne.
The Marquis, she says. Of course, it is good to be humble. She makes sure we are.
Just now, it is difficult for her. I think she will soften when she has her heart's desire. Even as he says it, he knows it is not true. Jane lowers her head, looks up at him from under her eyelids.
That is my humble face. Do you think it will serve?
He laughs. It would take you anywhere. When the dancers are resting, fanning themselves from the galliards, pavans and almands, he and Wyatt sing the little soldier's air. Scaramella to the war has gone, with his shield, his lance. It is melancholy, as songs are, whatever the words when the light is failing and the human voice unaccompanied fades in the shadows of the room. Charles Brandon asks him,
What is it about, that song? Is it about a lady?
No, it is just about a boy who goes off to war.
What are his fortunes?
Scaramella Falagala. It's all one big holiday to him.
Those were better days, the Duke says, soldiering.
The King sings to the lute, his voice strong, true, plangent. As I walk the woods so wild. Some women weep, a little the worse for strong Italian wines. At Canterbury, Archbishop Warham lies cold on a slab. Coins of the realm are laid on his eyelids, as if to seal into his brain for eternity the image of his king. He's waiting to go down under the pavement of the cathedral in the dank charnel vacancy by Becket's bones. Anne sits still as a statue, her eyes on her lover. Only her restless fingers move. She clutches on her lap one of her little dogs, and her hands run over and over its fur, twisting its curls. As the last note dies, candles are brought in. October, and we are going to Calais. A train 2,000 strong, stretched from Windsor to Greenwich, from Greenwich across the green fields of Kent to Canterbury. To a duke, an entourage of 40, to a marquis 35, to an earl 24, while a viscount must scrape by with 20, and he with Rafe and any clerks he can pack into the ship's ratholes. The king is to meet his brother France, who intends to oblige him by speaking to the Pope in favour of his new marriage. François has offered to marry one of his three sons. His three sons, how God must love him, to the Pope's niece, Catherine de' Medici. He says he will make it a precondition of the match that Queen Catherine is refused leave to appeal her case to Rome, and that his brother England is allowed to settle his marital affairs in his own jurisdiction, using his own bishops. These two potent monarchs will see each other for the first time since the meeting called the Field of the Cloth of Gold, which the Cardinal arranged. The King says the trip must cost less than that occasion, but when he is questioned on specifics, he wants more of that and two of those, everything bigger, plusher, more lavish, with more gilding. He's taking his own cooks and his own bed, his ministers and musicians, his horses, dogs and falcons, and his new marquis, whom Europe calls his concubine. He is taking the possible claimants to the throne, including Yorkist Lord Montague and the Lancastrian Nevilles, to show how tame they are and how secure are the Tudors. He's taking his gold plate, his linen, his pastry chefs and poultry pickers and poison taster. And he's even taking his own wine, which you might think is superfluous, but what do you know? Rafe, helping him pack his papers. I understand that King Francis will speak to Rome for the king's cause, but I am not sure what he gets out of this treaty. Wolsey always said that the making of a treaty is the treaty. Doesn't matter what the terms are, just that there are terms. It's the goodwill that matters. When that runs out, the treaty is broken, whatever the terms say. It is the processions that matter, the exchange of gifts, the royal games of bowls, the tilts, jousts and masks. These are not preliminaries to the process. They are the process itself. Anne, accustomed to the French court and French etiquette, sets out the difficulties in store. If the Pope were to visit him, then France could advance towards him, perhaps meeting him in a courtyard. But two monarchs meeting, once they are in sight, should take the same number of steps towards each other. And this works, unless one monarch, alas, were to take very small steps, forcing the other to cover the ground. By God, Charles Brandon bursts out, such a man would be a knave. Would Francis do that? Anne looks at him, lids half lowered. My Lord Suffolk, is your lady wife ready for the journey? Suffolk reddens. My wife is a former Queen of France. I am aware of it. François will be pleased to see her again. He thought her very beautiful, though of course she was young then. My sister is beautiful still, Henry says, pacific. But a tempest is boiling up inside Charles Brandon, and it breaks with a yell like a crack of thunder. You expect her to wait on you? On Boleyn's daughter? Pass you your gloves, madam, and serve you first at dinner? Make your mind up to it. That day will never come. Anne turns to Henry, her hand fastening on his arm. Before your face, he humiliates me. Charles, Henry says, leave us now and come back when you are master of yourself, not a moment before. He sighs, makes a sign. Cromwell, go after him. The Duke of Suffolk is seething and steaming. Fresh air, my lord, he suggests. Autumn has come already. There is a raw wind from the river. It lifts a flurry of sodden leaves, which flap in their path like the flags of some miniature army. I always think Windsor is a cold place. Don't you, my lord? I mean the situation, not just the castle. His voice runs on, soothing low. If I were the king, I would spend more time at the palace in Woking. You know, it never snows there. At least, not once in 20 years. If you were king, Brandon stumps downhill, if Anne Boleyn can be queen, why not? I take that back. I should have used a more humble expression. Brandon grunts. She will never appear, my wife, in the train of that harlot. My lord, you had better think her chaste. We all do. Her lady mother trained her up, and she was a great whore, let me tell you. Liz Boleyn, Liz Howard as was. She was the first to take Henry to bed. I know these things. I am his oldest friend. 17, and he didn't know where to put it. His father kept him like a nun. But none of us believe that story now, about Monseigneur's wife. Monseigneur Christ in heaven! He likes to be called that. It is no harm. Her sister Mary trained her up. And Mary was trained in a brothel. Do you know what they do in France? My lady wife told me. Well, not told me, but she wrote it down for me in Latin.
The man has a cockstand, and she takes it in her mouth. Can you imagine such a thing? A woman who can do such a filthy proceeding, can you call that a virgin?
My lord, if your wife will not go to France, if you cannot persuade her, shall we say that she is ill? It would be something you could do for the king, whom you know is your friend. It would save him from... He almost says, from the lady's harsh tongue. But he backs out of that sentence and says something else. It would save face. Brandon nods. They are still heading towards the river, and he tries to check their pace because soon Anne will expect him back with news of an apology. When the Duke turns to him, his face is a picture of misery.
It's true, anyway. She is ill. A beautiful little...
He makes a gesture, his hands cupping the air. All fallen away.
I love her, anyway. She's as thin as a wafer. I say to her, Mary, I will wake up one day and I won't be able to find you. I'll take you for a thread in the bed linen.
I'm so sorry, he says. He rubs his face.
Ah, God. Go back to Harry, will you? Tell him we can't do this. He will expect you to come to Calais if your lady wife cannot. I don't like to leave her, you see.
Anne is unforgiving, he says. Hard to please. Easy to offend.
My lord, be guided by me.
Brandon grunts.
We all are. We must be.
You do everything, Cromwell.
You are everything now. We say, how did it happen? We ask ourselves.
The Duke sniffs.
We ask ourselves, but by the steaming blood of Christ, we have no bloody answer.
The steaming blood of Christ. It's an oath worthy of Thomas Howard, the senior duke. When did he become the interpreter of dukes, their explainers? He asks himself, but he has no bloody answer. When he returns to the king and the queen-to-be, they're looking lovingly into each other's faces.
The Duke of Suffolk begs pardon, he says.
Yes, yes, the king says. I'll see you tomorrow, but not too early. You would think they were already man and wife. A languorous night before them, filled with marital delights. You would think so, except that he has Mary Boleyn's word for it, that the Marquisate has brought Henry only the right to caress her sister's inner thigh. Mary tells him this, and doesn't even put it in Latin. Whenever she spends time alone with the king, Anne reports back to her relations, no detail spared. You have to admire her, her measured exactness, her restraint. She uses her body like a soldier, conserving its resources, like one of the masters in the anatomy school at Padua. She divides it up and names every part, this my thigh, this my breast, this my tongue. Perhaps in Calais, he says, perhaps he will get what he wants then. She will have to be sure. Mary walks away. She stops and turns back, her face troubled. Anne says, Cromwell is my man. I don't like her to say that. In ensuing days, other questions emerged to torment the English party. Which royal lady will be hostess to Anne when they meet the French? Queen Eleanor will not, you cannot expect it, as she's the Emperor's sister, and family feeling is touched by his disgrace's abandonment of Catherine. Francis's sister, the Queen of Navarre, pleads illness rather than receive the King of England's mistress. Is it the same illness that afflicts the poor Duchess of Suffolk? Anne asks. Perhaps, Francis suggests, it would be appropriate if the new Marquis were to be met by the Duchess of Vendôme, his own maîtresse en titre. Henry is so angry that it gives him toothache. Dr. Butts comes with his chest of specifics. A narcotic seems kindest, but when the king wakes he is still so mortified that for a few hours there seems no solution but to call the expedition off.
Can they not comprehend, can they not grasp, that Anne is no man's mistress, but a king's bride-to-be? But to comprehend that is not in Francis's nature. He would never wait more than a week for a woman he wanted. Pattern of chivalry, he, most Christian king. All he understands, Henry bellows, is rutting like a stag. But I tell you, when his rut is done, the other hearts will put him down. Ask any hunter. It is suggested, finally, that the solution will be to leave the future queen behind in Calais, on English soil, where she can suffer no insult, while the king meets Francis in Boulogne. Calais, a small city, should be more easily contained than London, even if people line up at the harbour side to shout, "Putain!" and "Great Whore of England!" If they sing obscene songs, we will simply refuse to understand them. At Canterbury, with the royal party in addition to the pilgrims from all nations, every house is packed from cellars to eaves. He and Rafe are lodged in some comfort and near the king, but there are lords in flea-bitten inns and knights in the back rooms of brothels, pilgrims forced into stables and outhouses and sleeping out under the stars. Luckily, the weather is mild for October. Any year before this, the king would have gone to pray at Becket's shrine and leave a rich offering. But Becket was a rebel against the crown, not the sort of archbishop we like to encourage at the moment. In the cathedral, the incense is still hanging in the air from Warham's interment, and prayers for his soul are a constant drone like the buzz of a thousand hives. Letters have gone to Cranmer, lying somewhere in Germany at the Emperor's travelling court. Anne has begun to refer to him as the Archbishop-elect. No one knows how long he'll take getting home. With his secret, Rafe says. Of course, he says, his secret, written down the side of the page. Rafe visits the shrine. It is his first time. He comes back wide-eyed, saying it is covered in jewels the size of goose eggs. I know. Are they real, do you think? They show you a skull. They say it's Becket's. It's smashed up by the knights, but it's held together with a silver plate. For ready money, you can kiss it. They have a tray of his finger bones. They have his snotty handkerchief and a bit of his boot. And a vial they shake up for you. They say it's his blood. At Walsingham, they have a vial of the Virgin's milk. Christ, I wonder what that is. Rafe looks sick. The blood. You can tell it's water with some red soil in it. It floats about in clumps. Well, pick up that goose quill, plucked from the pinions of the angel Gabriel, and we will write to Stephen Vaughan. We may have to set him on the road to bring Thomas Cranmer home. It can't be soon enough, Rafe says. Just wait, master, till I wash Becket off my hands. Though he will not go to the shrine, the king wants to show himself to the people, Anne by his side. Leaving Mass, against all advice, he walks out among the crowds, his guards standing back, his counsellors around him. Anne's head darts on the slender stem of her neck, turning to catch the comments that come her way. People stretch out their hands to touch the king. Norfolk, at his elbow, stiff with apprehension, eyes everywhere. I don't care for this proceeding, Master Cromwell. He himself, having once been quick with a knife, is alert for movements below the eyeline. But the nearest thing to a weapon is an outsized cross, wielded by a bunch of Franciscan monks. The crowd gives way to them, to a huddle of lay priests in their vestments, a contingent of Benedictines from the abbey, and in the midst of them a young woman in the habit of a Benedictine nun. Majesty, Henry turns. By God, this is the Holy Maid, he says. The guards move in, but Henry holds up a hand. Let me see her. She is a big girl, and not so young, perhaps 28. Plain face, dusky, excited, with an urgent flush. She pushes towards the king, and for a second he sees him through her eyes. A blur of red gold and flushed skin, a ready priapic body,
a hand like a ham that stretches out to take her by her nunly elbow.
"Madam, you have something to say to me?"
She tries to curtsy, but his grip won't let her.
"I am advised by heaven," she says, "by the saints with whom I converse, that the heretics around you must be put into a great fire, and if you do not light that fire, then you yourself will burn."
"Which heretics? Where are they? I do not keep heretics about my person."
"Here is one."
Anne shrinks against the king. Against the scarlet and gold of his jacket she melts like wax.
"And if you enter into a form of marriage with this unworthy woman, you will not reign 7 months."
"Come, madam. 7 months? Round it off, can you not? What sort of prophet says 7 months?
"That is what heaven tells me."
"And when the 7 months are up, who will replace me? Speak up. Say who you would like to be king instead of me." The monks and priests are trying to draw her away. This was not part of their plan.
"Lord Montague, he is of the blood. The Marquis of Exeter, he is blood royal."
She in turn tries to pull away from the king.
"I see your lady mother," she says, "surrounded by pale fires."
Henry drops her as if her flesh were hot.
"My mother, where?" "I have been looking for the Cardinal of York. I have searched heaven, hell, and purgatory, but the Cardinal is not there."
"Surely she is mad," Anne says. "She is mad and must be whipped. If she is not, she must be hanged." One of the priests says,
"Madam, she is a very holy person. Her speech is inspired."
"Get her out of my way," Anne says.
"Lightning will strike you,"
the nun tells Henry. He laughs uncertainly.
Norfolk erupts into the group, teeth clenched, fist raised. "Drag her back to her whorehouse before she feels this, by God!"
In the melee, one monk hits another with a cross. The maid is drawn backwards, still prophesying. The noise from the crowd rises, and Henry grasps Anne by the arm and pulls her back the way they came. He himself follows the maid, sticking close to the back of the group, till the crowd thins and he can tap one of the monks on the arm and ask to speak to her. "I was a servant of Wolsey," he says. "I want to hear her message."
This ends Disc 13.